Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Soundcheck Podcast from WNYC, made on Varick Street.
Everybody's joking now. The clock's run out. Time's up. Over. Plow. Snap back to reality. Oh, there goes gravity. Oh, there goes rabbit. He choked. He's so mad, but he won't give up. Daddies, he know he won't have.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Mick Jagger, Patti Smith, David Bowie, Lou Reed, Eminem, Bono. There are lots of instantly recognizable names in the rock world. In the world of rock music criticism, Lisa Robinson's name is just as big. As a journalist with unparalleled access, she's been present at what seems like every significant milestone in pop music. Now she's collected a huge swath of stories with hundreds of names, many famous, some obscure, in a new memoir called There Goes Gravity, A Life in Rock and Roll. Lisa Robinson, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. So nice to be here.
So the title does reference this Eminem song.
It does yourself. Reference the Eminem song, yes, because I just love, first of all, I love the movie, 8 Mile. I love the song. And my husband just always loved that line, There Goes Gravity. And, of course, I couldn't come up with a title. It took months and months and months of going through every imaginable music that I, like, All Tomorrow's Parties, no, there's a festival named that.
Right.
You know, I'll Be Your Mirror, no, that's too corny. All Night Long, no way I was going to name my book after a Lionel Richie song. After Midnight, again, Eric Clapton, you know, Thelonious Monk. So it was down to the wire where the publisher literally said to me, we need a title by 5 o'clock. And I started rattling off names from a list to a friend of mine. And I got to There Goes Gravity, which Richard Robinson, my husband, had put on there. And she said, wait a minute, what's that? And I said, it's a line from an Eminem song. And she went, I like that. I said, okay, fine. That's what I'm calling it.
Well, you know what? I mean, as often happens with things that work out really well and are just sort of like spur-of-the-moment decisions, you can actually kind of make that title make sense. There Goes Gravity, the sense of being cast adrift and soaring up into the stratospheric heights where you have spent much of your career with some of the most famous names on the planet.
Well, also, when I said that to her, I said, what does that title imply to you? And she said, no rules apply. Mm. And I said, oh, okay, that's good, because that really sort of covers it.
Yeah. Now, how did you get the kind of consistent and repeated access to Mick Jagger and Robert Plant and the rest of Led Zeppelin and The Clash and Michael Jackson and all the others?
Well, first of all, when I started, you have to put it in context.
Yeah.
We were talking around 1970. There were maybe 6 people writing about this music. I was one of the few women, and I was one of the few who was not a critic. I wasn't reviewing albums. I wasn't writing things like, I remember in Rolling Stone, a writer named John Mendelsohn wrote about Led Zeppelin's Lemon song. And to this day, I remember it, and I'm sure that Robert Plant does too. He said, he sings notes that only a dog can hear. And I thought, wait a minute, that's not fair. I saw Led Zeppelin in concert, and having been brought up in a household where I heard Lead Belly, I heard the blues, I heard Woody Guthrie, but yet I also was a fan of Kaleidoscope and the Incredible String Band. These are all names from the 1960s and the early 1970s, but also Fairport Convention and Joni Mitchell, and I heard all those influences, Eastern music, blues, folk music from California, Laurel Canyon. I heard all of that in Zeppelin's music. Mm. So when I first went to meet them, I just started babbling to them about all those things I heard. And I think they were so stunned that somebody, well, agreed with them for a start. And I wasn't even really flattering them, because I wasn't taken with them. I wasn't intimidated by any of them. I mean, this goes into another sort of tangent, but having grown up in New York City, having snuck out of my house at the age of 12 to see Thelonious Monk and Miles Davis and Horace Silver and John Coltrane and Sonny Rollins, I was a little more sophisticated.
To impress?
Well, perhaps more so than other rock critics, who were mostly guys who were either in awe of these guys or jealous of them or angry at them or trying to make their name writing about them. So I came in with this different attitude, very chatty, very gossipy, exactly the way I'm talking to you now. And I think it was slightly refreshing. So once I got in that first situation with Led Zeppelin, everything else just sort of happened.
Hey, ladies, got the love I need. Maybe more than enough. Oh, darling, 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 walk a while with me. Oh, you got so much, so much, so much.
Speaking with Lisa Robinson about her book called There Goes Gravity, A Life in Rock and Roll. Led Zeppelin famously did not do well with the critics early in their career. You were an exception, although, as you say, you were not a critic, but you were someone who wrote very optimistic things about their future. And
I wrote optimistic things, but I also was myself. I was cynical. I was acerbic. I would write funny things about them if I saw that.
Yeah, yeah.
And not necessarily bitchy things, but funny things, cynical stuff. And now we're like 40 years later and they get a Kennedy Center Honors. It's just funny how these things happen.
Now, you mentioned that, you know, there were a handful of people doing this sort of rock music journalism, very few women. It seems to me, especially in the chapter devoted to your time with the Rolling Stones, it seems that in your case, being a woman actually may have worked to your advantage. Mick Jagger seems to have, whether he was doing it consciously or not, just flirted with you constantly.
Now, Mick didn't really flirt with me. Mick was just very sort of campy and funny and gossipy with me. Mick used to love it. Mick made fun of the fact that I wrote about clothes because I had a column in Cream magazine, which was sort of a underground rock magazine at the time, and I called it Eleganza after a black pimp clothing catalog. And I wrote a lot about clothes, and a lot of my so-called male colleagues were furious about this. They were so offended. They felt this was so decadent, you know, that this was supposed to be the music that was changing the world and it was the alternative culture. And the fact that I wrote about people wearing suits or shoes or whatever I wrote about, they didn't like. But Mick must have read it because the first time I ever met him, the first thing I said to him was, those are the tackiest shoes I've ever seen. And then from then on, he would always sort of sidle up to me in this very sort of Monty Python-ish campy voice and say things like, Jimmy Page was wearing a pink satin suit and white socks, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the shoes. You know, it was like that. So yeah. I wouldn't say it was flirting. I would just say it was kind of gossipy and campy.
But I cannot imagine him having done that with any of the male journalists who were on the tour then.
Well, no, probably not. And in addition, what you have to understand is my husband worked at RCA Records. He signed David Bowie, Lou Reed, and the Kinks. So I was friendly with them. I also had a friend who introduced me to Roxy Music in London very early on, so I was friendly with Brian Ferry. So I knew Led Zeppelin from having traveled with them. There's this network of British rock musicians, and they all wanted to know about each other. So I would gossip off the record. I didn't write a lot of it, but just in conversation, Mick would say to me, so what's Brian Ferry doing now? And unfortunately, at that time, Mick was sneaking around with Brian Ferry's girlfriend, so he put me in an uncomfortable position.
Right. So did this then put you in a difficult journalistic position? Because you're being paid to, you know, I mean, if you had written that stuff, Your magazine's sales would have skyrocketed.
Well, actually, I did write a lot of that stuff, and the magazine sales did not skyrocket because it was a very limited audience. I was writing for some very small little rock magazines. Then I got a syndicated column. I was the American editor for the New Musical Express in London, which all the British rock stars wanted to be in because their parents all read that. So they all wanted their parents to know how big they were in America. And I wrote exactly some of that stuff. I did. I wrote a very chatty, gossipy, New York-oriented column. But you have to understand, it was such a different time. The term conflict of interest did not really exist. As I said, there were about six of us doing this, then maybe 10, then maybe 20. But it wasn't the kind of career choice that it's become today. People didn't study Miley Cyrus in college. You know, people didn't study Beyonce. I mean, people did not take rock journalism classes. You know, Questlove does this great course at NYU on Prince, but that was unheard of then. Nobody did anything like that.
Right. We're speaking with Lisa Robinson. She's my guest on Soundcheck. Her book is just, it's a romp through four decades of rock history called There Goes Gravity, A Life in Rock and Roll. I want to play this song from The Clash. There's a whole chapter about your, you really, as many of us did at the time, did think this was the only band that matters, which was the slogan.
Did you think so, too?
I loved them. Late 70s, I thought, this is right now the best band on the planet.
The minute I saw them backstage at the Electric Circus in Manchester, I saw them. They'd been together for like 3 weeks. I mean, Paul Simonon did not know how to play the bass. Patti Smith had been dating him, so she told me to look them up. I taped the show. That tape, you still can hear the urgency in Joe Strummer's voice. It's still, you can get what that did. And all of a sudden, it was like everybody who had long hair looked out just dated. Yeah. And everybody who was singing these sort of low, sweet, laid-back, Laurel Canyon, California kind of music, this just gave it such a shot in the arm. I was just totally
blown away. Or a kick in the pants, yeah, as the case may be.
Yeah, I was totally blown away.
The Clash, from 1977, the song's Complete Control. Clash, a little bit of Complete Control. Lisa Robinson's with me, the contributing editor at Vanity Fair, veteran music journalist, and author of the new memoir, There Goes Gravity, A Life in Rock and Roll. And two things about that song. There's that line, Lisa, I don't trust you, so why do you trust me? I mean, the idea of you had to gain the trust of these people to be able to get into the inner circle and then stay there, and then be able to write about them and still have them let you come back.
First of all, I just want to say that I forgot how great that song was. I would love that music if I heard it for the first time now. It's not that I'm nostalgic for that time. I just think that's such a great song and they have so much energy. But as far as the trust issue is concerned, when I went backstage to see them after the first time I saw them at the Manchester Electric Circus, I ran back completely, like, hysterical, and I went, you took my breath away. That's unbelievable. I'm going back to London. I'm calling every record company president I know, and I'm going to try to get you a deal. And so that was hello. And, you know, they, of course, loved that. They thought, well, here's a journalist from America who's traveled with Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones, and even though she's just a girl, she writes for the New Music Express, so she can help us. And I actually did run back to the Montcalm Hotel and called every record company president I knew. And some of their responses are really pretty hilarious. Were pretty hilarious.
All right. So that's the trust thing is one thing that song raised. The other was the litany of ghosts in this story. you know? Yeah. Joe Strummer of The Clash, Freddie Mercury of Queen, John Lennon, the Ramones, John Bonham of Led Zeppelin, Michael Jackson, all the way up to Lou Reed. It becomes almost like if this book were a song, that would be the chorus. That would be the refrains.
Yeah.
The passing of these great artists.
It's part of it is age. Some of it is drugs. Some of it sort of a sybaritic, hedonistic lifestyle in the case of John Bonham, certainly. John Lennon was a murderer. Lou Reed was very ill for a very long time. Lou Reed died after I had finished the book. You know, that was something that we fortunately managed to sneak in something at the last minute. But yeah, it's very poignant. It's sad, but the music is still with us. Right.
So there's also a lot about, you know, you talked about not being nostalgic for that time when, say, The Clash and Patti Smith and CBGBs were all happening. But there was a certain something in the air in New York around that time. Do you feel any of that still in the air in New York, or has it utterly changed?
Well, okay. I, of course, had the greatest time then because I was young. In the 70s, the bars were open till 4 in the morning. You could smoke anywhere, and everyone did. The city was not overrun by bicycles or strollers or, I'm serious, or nine people.
No, we just had rats and garbage and muggers.
I don't care. We had fun. I mean, it's like we didn't think of it like that. Nobody talked about how much an apartment cost because nobody really had any money. And artists came here. I bemoan the fact that it is no longer a city where artists can come and flourish. In the 70s, we did not have the internet, we did not have cell phones, we did not have Instagram, Tumblr, social media, Twitter. So scenes were allowed to develop. I don't think something like CBGB's could ever happen now. I don't. I mean, imagine The Clash playing someplace now for their first gig, when they'd been together for 3 weeks and Paul Simonon really didn't know how to play the bass, or even the Ramones going to CBGB's for the first time and yelling 1, 2, 3, 4 and racing at breakneck speed in a song that was under 2 minutes and having a whole bunch of people write all sorts of snarky things about them online, you know, they'd break up before anything could happen.
Or someone like Patti Smith. You know? I mean, who really took a couple of years to kind of mature that blend of poetry and punk that became uniquely hers.
Her whole androgynous look and her whole sort of thing that she did was so new. Mm. We had never seen, certainly not a woman, do anything like this before.
And at one point in the book you write that to this day, when you hear Horses, that album by Patti Smith, it's still kind of this striking and dramatic experience.
Well, it's still great. I mean, when you hear that stuff for the first time, and then you hear it again 40 years later, and it still has the same energy, then that means they did something right.
Smith, Gloria, from her 1975 album Horses, about which Lisa Robinson writes so beautifully in the new memoir There Goes Gravity, A Life in Rock and Roll. Lisa Robinson will be in conversation with Fran Lebowitz at the 92nd Street Y on May 8th. Fran is the dedicatee of this book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not all, I mean, we started by talking about Eminem, so it's not all like down memory lane, 60s, 70s, 80s.
I love the music, you know, I still love the music. And to me, that was the important thing.
What do you love now? Who's out there now that's caught your ear lately?
I still have Yeezus, Kanye West's latest album, on a loop again and again and again and again and again. I'll listen to Saul Williams' List of Demands that Trent Reznor did with him years ago because I love that. You know, Gary Clark Jr., to me, is doing something so soulful and so important because he's reminding people of the blues.
Yeah.
He stupidly gets compared to Jimi Hendrix because no other black electric guitar player sounded like that since Jimi Hendrix. But he's so different.
Yeah,
he does such a different kind of thing.
Well, you know, Gary Clark Jr. did a solo set here on Soundcheck and was amazing.
Yeah, he's amazing.
So we're going to wrap up with a little bit of his music. But Lisa Robinson is the author of the new memoir called There Goes Gravity, A Life in Rock and Roll. May 8th, she'll be in conversation with Fran Lebowitz at the 92nd Street Y. And you can bet there are many, many, many more stories than what we've gotten to today. Lisa, great having you with us on Soundcheck.
Thank you so much. It's really been fun.
I don't believe in competition.
That does it for this podcast, but make sure to check out our archives of live performances, in-studio videos, exclusive music previews, and much more at soundcheck.org. I'm John Schaefer. See you next time.